I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. In this episode of The Unmistakable Creative, I speak with Vic Tiwari about his journey from Wharton Business School to Broadway producer and writing a graphic novel about the fifth Beatle, Brian Epstein. And if you're loving the show, the best way you could support us is with a small donation at unmistakabletipjar.com. Vivek, welcome to The Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure to be on.
Yeah, I came across you by way of our mutual friend, Michael Roderick, who is really, truly a mega connector and seems to know all sorts of fascinating people.
Yeah, he
and
sure is.
When he showed me, you know, the TEDx talks that you gave and kind of told me a little bit about your story, I thought, yeah, this is a fascinating story about an Indian person who was definitely blazing a very unconventional trail. So on that note, can you tell us a bit about yourself, your background, your journey, your story, and how that has brought you to what you're up to in the world today?
Sure. So I was born here in New York City, where you are calling me. And although my parents were born in Guyana, South America, and their parents were born in India. So we are a family of Indian origin. And my father's side of the family is from Uttar Pradesh. And my mother's side of the family is half from Bihar and half from Rajasthan. So India really is my homeland. And I grew up here in New York, essentially the first generation American in my family, son of immigrants. And I found myself in business school in 1991. I enrolled in the Wharton School of Business. And what was expected of me was to join my family business. And my family business, it's very diversified, but in brief, it's food products and financial securities. And, my family expected that if I decided I didn't want to join my family business, then I was expected to become a doctor or an engineer. I mean, these are the things that are expected of young people of Indian origin who have some degree of opportunity and means, is that they become doctors or engineers or go into technology or maybe the law, or if they have a family business, they join their family business. And growing up in New York City, as I did, I was born in 73, and it was a fabulous time to grow up in New York City to be exposed to the arts. While my parents didn't work in the arts, they loved the arts. And I grew up on 12th Street, and they were constantly taking me uptown to Broadway and Lincoln Center, and I was seeing ballet and musicals and opera and all that sort of thing. And then as soon as I was allowed out of the house on my own, I was going downtown to places like CBGB's and the Old Ritz and the Danceteria, and I was seeing punk rock shows and early Sonic Youth concerts and sort of the birth of experimental garage rock. And so I really grew up with a very well-rounded sense of the arts, and that's what I loved. I loved the arts, and I wanted to work in the arts and entertainment spheres. And so when I found myself in business school, I was very conflicted. You know, I was very stressed out that I was going to wind up in a field that I was not interested in and that I was not passionate about. And then I was, ironically also stressed out that maybe I wasn't going to wind up in that field and I was going to wind up disappointing my family, who I love very much. And so it's a trauma that I think a lot of young people face. And if I may be so bold, I think a lot of people of our, ethnic background face. And it was during this period that I couldn't find a living, breathing mentor to help me carve my career in the arts. And instead, what I found was the Brian Epstein story. You know, he died in 1967 before I was born. So I describe him as my historical mentor, you know, somebody whose life I've studied since 1991 as a model of both what to do and what not to do. I mean, I think mentors teach you what to do and what not to do. And that's what Brian Epstein really became for me. You know, as a gay Jewish man from Liverpool, going against the grain of what was expected of him to manage a rock and roll band and dream about elevating pop music into an art form, you know, that his story really connected to me as a young person of Indian origin dreaming about writing comic books and producing Broadway musicals. So I know that's a very long-winded answer to your question, but I hope that gives you a sense of sort of both the practical and the emotional journey that I've taken in the past, 20 plus years.
Yeah. So that, that raises a ton of questions. And I think it's really interesting that you grew up in an Indian family where you're continually exposed to the arts, because I don't know that that's actually typical.
No, it probably isn't. Although I don't know that it's that unusual. If for someone growing up here in the city, because in New York, especially in the 70s, 80s, when for rock and roll clubs, for example, it was 21 to drink, but it was 16 to get in. Mm-hmm. So, nowhere was carding for 16. So if you just wanted to see the show, you could get into like any venue you wanted to. Being able to have access to that as just a young person getting out of the house for the first time, that wasn't typically unusual for people of my age growing up in the city. And my parents, just with an interest in the arts, it was there. It was, so much of New York is cultural that it was, it was very easy for them to bestow that on me. Mm-hmm. Although you're right, I don't know that a lot of Indian families necessarily grow up loving the arts, which I think also is a bit paradoxical, because India has certainly a very, very rich artistic history, but it is what it is, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's going to be a really interesting discussion about all of that. But I think the first place I really want to take this is that whole cultural conflict that we often face as first generation Indians and people who have chosen to do something in the arts. And how do you resolve that conflict between sort of going and doing what you love and, dealing with the disappointment that you may face from your family? It's something that I've wrestled with a lot personally, so I'm really curious. And I don't imagine there aren't people listening to this from many ethnic backgrounds who feel very much the same way.
Yeah, I guess I take a very optimistic look at these things. And, I'm a dad now. I have a 6-year-old son and a 3-year-old daughter. And now that I am a dad, I really do get it. I understand where our Indian parents and uncles and aunts are coming from when they say, we want you to be a doctor or a lawyer or an engineer, because you want the best for your children. And those are great fields that for the most part are stable and lucrative. Mm-hmm. And now that I'm a dad, I want that for my kids too. So it's funny, like when I was younger, I didn't totally get it. And now I really do understand where they're coming from, and they're not wrong. That doesn't mean that they're right, but they're not wrong. And at the heart of that, I think, as being a parent, is not so much the field itself, but the fact that you want your kids, as I said, to be in a position that's lucrative and stable. Mm-hmm. And so I think that if you pursue your dreams with passion and persistence and an incredible amount of hard work, if you choose an unorthodox path for yourself, as I did, everything is more difficult. My path was very rewarding, but it was really hard, However, if you pursue your dreams with passion, persistence, and a ton of hard work, like, you will get to that place, I believe, where you are making enough money to make you happy, you'll be stable. Mm-hmm. And I think if you show your family that, then they will get what they always wanted for you. That doesn't mean there won't be a ton of heartache getting there.
Sure.
When you're sleeping on couches and your parents are thinking you're wasting your life and whatever. But if you keep your eye on the prize, your mind on the mission, eventually when you have produced that Broadway show that's a hit, mm-hmm. and you're getting a good revenue from that, then your family will start to think, huh, maybe there is something to this, and he's doing what he loves, and he's making good money, and he's stable. So that's really what I wanted all along,
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I can relate, and it's funny because I've been going through some personal challenges, and I realize, really what, even though, sometimes it feels like there's this conflict, I realize that my parents have the best of intentions, actually. It's
Absolutely.
Not that they're trying to make my life difficult, but they actually, they want to see it become easier for me.
That's exactly right, yeah.
And, amazingly enough, as I've going through some challenges, I call my dad, and I, in a million years, I never thought he would say this. I actually asked him, I said, do you think it's time for me to quit? And, it's been 5 years, and I said, am I at that point? And he said, No, which was shocking to me. Because I thought all along, all he ever thought I should do was go do something a bit more stable. You know, I want to get into this whole, the entire journey and the ups and downs of it all in a second, but there's one other thing that I want to ask you. You know, you mentioned having all these sort of cultural and artistic inputs, and this is something that always really intrigues me about people who have creative careers is, you know, how the intersection of all those various creative inputs and all that exposure to various art forms has influenced and shaped your worldview and the way you create what you do in the world today.
I'm going to ask you to ask that again. I got a tiny bit lost.
Okay. So, I mean, you've been exposed to numerous art forms throughout your childhood. And I guess really, you know, as those things intersect, those are stimuli that become inputs to us. And I'm curious how that has influenced and shaped what you do as a creator and how that's informed your worldview.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, certainly as a creator, you know, as I mentioned earlier, you know, I grew up with my parents, you know, taking me uptown to opera and ballet and that sort of thing. And as soon as I was out of the house on my own, I was going downtown to see punk rock and experimental guitar rock and that sort of thing. And that was very unusual. You know, I went to an all-boys school called Collegiate on the Upper West Side here in New York, and I remember having conversations with my high school friends, my high school guy friends, trying to explain why I thought, you know, punk rock and ballet were compatible, you know. And people thought that was really strange, and I didn't, you know. They thought that was a fairly bizarre duality, and to me it felt pretty normal. You know, some of the things that were going on at the New York City Ballet with the experimental dancing that they were doing, to me, like the stuff that Sonic Youth was doing downtown at the rock clubs, you know, those two worlds were very similar, and that if the fans of each of those worlds would get over whatever it was, their arrogance, their fear, their whatever, and just start to experience the other side's art, you know, they would appreciate it and their minds would be blown, is what I thought, you know. And so many years later, as I find myself a creator, I try to always do that, to be very multidisciplinary. And probably the easiest example is Green Day's American Idiot. You know, I was one of the producers on that show, and that was literally merging the two worlds of punk rock and Broadway. You know, and everybody said we were crazy, and they said, you know, Green Day fans don't come to Broadway and kids don't come to Broadway. And we said, that's nonsense. You know, you build a great show and give people something they want to see and make sure they know it's there, market it to them, and they will come. You know, and so I guess I've always tried to do that. I've always tried to work on shows that have some personal meaning to me and that maybe in some small way at least, you know, push the medium that they exist in forward in some capacity. And so I think that is very much a product of how I grew up and the stimuli, as I put it, as you put it, mm-hmm. That I was exposed to, because I really was exposed to a lot of what might seem radically different stimuli, but to me didn't feel radically different. And so I've always tried to bring those you know, sort of unorthodox mediums together as a creator. And, you know, on the personal side of things, you know, to give really my family some credit, you know, my grandfather, who really started all those family businesses, you know, he was the head of my family, and he was, you know, like many Indian families, he was the eldest male, and so he kind of was the head of the nuclear family. You know, when I was growing up, if I ever got in any trouble, it was never, "I'll tell your dad." It was always, "I'll tell your grandfather." You know, he was the boss. And he was a great influence on me, and he always told me, you need to do what you love, and you need to work for yourself, you know, and that's how you will be both fulfilled and how you will do your best work. And I grew up loving the arts. And I, you know, to be honest, I think when my grandfather said work for yourself, to him, working for the family business was working for yourself. I think that's what he meant, you know. So I'm not sure when he told me that he was really thinking that he was encouraging me to write comic books. Mm-hmm. But that's surreptitiously that's what he wound up doing, you know. So you know, by growing up in this environment that with an attitude in the back of my head that I need to do what I love and I need to work for myself, you know, that's how I wound up deciding to work in the arts and entertainment industries and be an entrepreneur in those industries.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things I'm really also curious about is how do we you know, look at the intersection of all the stimuli in our own lives and apply it to the work that we're doing and, you know, find meaning in the work that we're doing?
You know, I mean, that's a hard question for me to answer because it feels to me just like that's how I live my life. You know, I mean, I really do go back to that thing that my grandfather said, which is like, you just got to do what you love and you need to work for yourself. And for me, it's like, you know, I never break it down as to like, you know, how do I apply the stimuli that are around me into what I do? It's just like, I try to just work on things that I'm passionate about. Mm-hmm. You know, I really do believe that, you know, if there's one message to the Brian Epstein story, and it's the mantra I've lived my life by, it's that no dream is too impossible and no person too unlikely to realize that dream. And I guess the addendum to that would be, you know, as long as you pursue it with passion, persistence, and a ton of heart, and we're willing to put in a ton of hard work. Mm-hmm. But if you are, then nothing is too crazy or too impossible. So it's never something where I'm like, how do I absorb this into my life? It's like, let me just live my life and live my life with passion and persistence and surround myself with people I care about and projects I care about. And if I'm doing all those things, then my work will be good work. Mm-hmm. You know, it may not be easy work. You know, I keep wanting to reiterate that to the audience, like, you know, because I sometimes feel like I'm being very motivational speakerish,
right?
You know, and it's important to realize, like, yeah, I do believe in chasing your dreams, but you know, if your dreams are unorthodox, then be prepared to work your ass off for them, also. You know.
Well, actually, that makes a perfect setup for where I want to take the story next. You know, it's interesting because we share a similar background. I was in business school, and business school ended up being the catalyst for putting me on this very unorthodox path. And I'm really curious kind of to hear about that moment when you find yourself at Wharton of all places where you think, okay, you know what, I'm not meant to do what is typically the byproduct of a Wharton degree. And also, you know, navigating the emotional challenges of, you know, going down this unorthodox path, especially when it's hard, you know, how you do that. And really, you know, more than anything, I want to hear about the really darker, gritty moments of all of this for you.
I have to be honest, like, there aren't a ton of them because, like, I just really kept in mind, and again, maybe this is my just trying to be an optimist mm-hmm. about things, but I just tried to keep my eyes and my plans on doing things that I loved, you know, and I really do believe that in that way, it really is a matter of perspective, you know, and I think you can really just shift your perspective. You know, if you choose to work in a field that's difficult, and as a result, you're like, you know, sleeping on your friend's couch and you know, getting your buddy to help you, you know, make a plate of ramen noodles to eat that evening, then, like, you know, there are two ways of looking at it. It's like, oh man, this sucks. Like, I'm sleeping on a couch and I'm eating ramen noodles. Or the other way to look at it is like, this is awesome. I am finding a way to do what I love, you know? And I think if you keep that other perspective, then there aren't really dark moments. You know, the only dark and gritty moments that I've ever faced is when I start realizing that, like, or I'm sorry, let me put it this way. Any time that something has started to feel dark or gritty, then the takeaway message to me is like, then I shouldn't be doing this because that means I don't love it. Mm-hmm. You know, that means whatever this project is that I've taken on, I'm doing it for the wrong reason. I'm doing it because I think it will make money, or I think it will be a hit, or whatever the reason might be, but I'm doing it for the wrong reason. Because if I was doing it for passion, doesn't necessarily mean my life would be easy, but it wouldn't feel dark. Yeah. You know, feel like I'm working on something that there is a very bright light at the end of that tunnel. And so as a result, like, you focus on that light up ahead and it doesn't feel so dark.
That's actually a really interesting way of looking at it. And, you know, I really appreciate what you said about not choosing to do something for the money, because I can tell you anytime I have tried to make something or create something specifically in the hopes that it would result in some sort of monetary outcome or gain, it's always been incredibly unfulfilling and it almost never results in the monetary gain.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, that is something that I very much believe, but I will also be practical and say that, like, you also need to, you know, pick your projects wisely.
Right.
You know, I mean, like, I decided to put a quote-unquote punk rock album on a Broadway stage, but, like, you know, the band that I chose was Green Day and the album I chose was American Idiot. Mm-hmm. You know, American Idiot is an internationally multi-platinum album. You know, it sold millions of copies all over the world. you know, and Green Day are like virtually a household name. Mm-hmm. You know, like, you know, some of my producers' grandparents knew who Green Day, or, you know, they may not have known their music, but they heard of them,
right.
You know. And so, like, you know, I didn't choose, you know, Husker Du, who is another band that I love. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Zen Arcade would probably be a really cool musical. But, like, that would be difficult, you know, and difficult to the extent of I'm not sure that that would be the, you know, monetarily where I should be spending my time, given that I also have a family to feed.
Right.
You know? And then, you know, but if that's the case and your dream is to put Zen Arcade, you know, onto the stage, then maybe you do need to do American Idiot first, mm-hmm. you know, and then benefit from that. And then eventually you'll get to Zen Arcade, you know? So I do want to say, like, you know, I don't want to be too disingenuous when I suggest that, like, I've never done anything, you know, with monetary gain in mind.
Sure.
But monetary gain can't be the primary reason.
Yeah.
It's the primary reason, then I really do think the project is out to fail. However, you know, I don't, when, you know, we're talking about theater, like, I don't operate in nonprofit theater. There is a very big industry that's nonprofit theater, mm-hmm. and I don't work in that industry. And, you know, and so since I work in for-profit theater, you know, I have investors I need to, you know, take care of and make money for. And, you know, that's part of my job is to do right by my investors. And so I don't want to be too disingenuous and say that I haven't done things, you know, for the money. Mm-hmm. I guess the better way of putting it is I try to balance things and, you know, if something feels dark, then I need to take a look at it. And sometimes the answer is because, well, the main reason you did this was for the money, you know, and like, and do you really need to be doing that? And 9 times out of 10, the answer was no. But, you know, really it was 9 times out of 10. Like, mm-hmm. I'm, you know, the entertainment field is a very difficult place to make money. And every once in a while, you need to do something to make money. And I don't feel any shame in that. I also can say that I've never in my entire life worked on something that I wasn't proud of. But there, you know, there are definitely certain projects that I've been more passionate about than others.
You know, that's actually really interesting, and I really appreciate that perspective, because I think that in a lot of ways, you're right. I mean, we can become almost idealistic as artists, and idealistic to a fault, where it actually, you know, like you said, you know, sometimes you have to do what you have to do in order to make money.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, again, you know, it depends. I mean, I suppose it differs for everybody. You know, I suppose there might be some people who, you know, are just so wealthy or are, you know, have inherited something and they just haven't had to think about it. I don't know anyone like that myself. You know, even the people that I know that have a lot of money also have a lifestyle that they're used to, that they want to support, that you know, makes them need to work hard to continue to support that lifestyle and build their ambitions. So, you know, there is always a balance there. You know, I've got a family that I love and I want, and, you know, we talked about this earlier, you want the best for your kids, you know, and, you know, if my kids have a dream that's not to become a doctor or an engineer or something or a lawyer or something that might be stable enough to bring in immediate income, then I hope that I can help support them. But I'm not going to be able to help support them if I keep choosing projects that can't make any money.
Yeah.
You know, so it's it is something you do need to think about, you know?
Yeah, yeah, no doubt. So, you know, let's do this. I'd love to hear about the early part of sort of the trajectory and the build up to doing exactly what you do, and some of the earlier projects that you worked on. And then, you know, really, I want to start talking about your entire creative process for all of this.
Okay.
So, I mean, post business school, you know, you decide you want to get in this career in the arts. I mean, talk to us about some of this. Talk to us about the journey from there to doing the stuff that you're doing today, like the projects that have led to all of it.
While I was at business school in Wharton, I was also working part time for Sony Music. I got a job working for Sony Music as a field rep in the Philadelphia area. So I got my start really at record labels. And I guess going all the way back before that, I got a music internship at a local music production and publishing company in Philadelphia. And so, you know, it was just that was a break into the business, but it was an unglamorous job as an intern. But through that, I started networking and I worked my way up to getting that Sony Music gig. And so after I graduated, I moved back to the city, back to New York, and I continued to work for record labels. I was working for Mercury Records for about 3 years, And then when Seagram's bought PolyGram, which owned Mercury and merged it with Universal, which Seagram's had already owned, you know, budgets were frozen. Everyone was miserable. You know, their people were worried about job security. And it was a moment where I should have, the responsible thing to do would probably have been to look for another job. So I started thinking about that. And I thought, you know, my dream has always been to work for myself, as we talked about earlier. And so I said, now's the right moment. You know, I've developed a pretty good reputation in the business. And while, you know, your Rolodex can always be bigger, I felt like I had a pretty good network already and of people who would be willing to help me and respected me. And I had already started to manage a local band on the side. So I had a project. And I thought, you know, rather than spending my time looking for another job, I'm going to set up shop for myself and start working for myself. So I did. And that was the birth of Tiwari Entertainment Group. And I gave it that very vague name because I knew that I wanted to work on a variety of different projects across the arts and entertainment spectrum, even though my prior experience up until that point had been in the music industry. And in a lot of ways, music really is my first love, so to speak. I also knew that I wanted to work in film, television, theater, graphic novels. You know, I didn't want to just work in the traditional music industry. And so I gave my company a name that would be vague enough that would allow me to take on any project within the arts and entertainment spheres that I was passionate about. And by being based here in New York City, I thought I should start with theater. You know, theater is kind of in my backyard, or Broadway, I should say, is right in my backyard. I suppose if I was growing up in LA, I might have thought, you know, I should start in film. But I was here in New York, and I thought, let me master the world of Broadway. And then I'll start expanding into other mediums. Looking back on it, I don't know that that's necessarily great advice. I would caution somebody to necessarily say, you know, that theater and film are so similar and, you know, one can lead to the other. That being said, I think there is some merit to it, and it definitely worked for me. You know, my thinking was the two aren't that different, you know, in terms of the development process, you know, developing a script, working with writers, working with agents, working with managers, getting a script done, attaching a director, attaching a cast, raising the financing. You know, it is a similar sort of development process. And in my head, you know, comparing big Broadway musicals to big films, the budgets of Broadway are in that comparative spectrum much smaller. You have more time to develop. You know, you can launch something out of state and see how it goes. Whereas big films, you know, when they launch, you've got like the first weekend really, or maybe two weekends. And if the film is doing poorly, you know, you're in trouble. Whereas, you know, in theater, you can maybe take your time a little bit more. So that was kind of my thinking behind the whole thing. And, you know, again, that really worked for me. I do think that there are analogies between theater and film that make sense, although I would caution somebody to necessarily assume that's a path that they should take. But that is very much the path that I took. And it really did work for me. You know, I got involved in theater. I met a group of gentlemen that were working on a project to open a Broadway Hall of Fame. And that was really basically through networking. I put word out to my network that I was looking to get involved in theater, and that's how I got introduced to those guys. And that project ended up not happening, but some of those folks moved on to work on Mel Brooks' The Producers, and they invited me to join that show. And I did, and that was the show that I really learned the ropes from. It was a phenomenally successful Broadway musical and a great show to learn from, and that's how I learned to produce. And after that, I helped with some of the international financing for Hairspray, and that show was very successful. And then I lead produced A Raisin in the Sun, and that show was incredibly successful. And so all of a sudden, I had a string of successes under my belt. And you know, when you've got some successes in entertainment, you know, the next one, I wouldn't say it necessarily comes easy, but it comes easier. Mm-hmm. You know, in theory, you know what you're doing, but also people think you know what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And so doors open for you, and doors from, you know, investors being willing to part with their money and trust you to, you know, people, you know, having leverage in negotiating deals. And so I found myself very much focusing on theater. And then it was, you know, several years after that, as I was developing the Fifth Beatle, that project felt like a film to me. And so it felt time to expand into film. And that's really what we're doing right now. Tiwari Entertainment Group is branching out into film.
Very, very cool. Let me ask you this. about sort of, you know, achieving success. You know, often I hear that people have this idea that success is going to drastically change everything in their lives. You know, I had Tucker Max here recently, and he says, you know, he's like, success doesn't make your problems just go away. You don't, you know, success doesn't heal the wounds you think it's going to heal. And the question for me, and this is something I've wrestled with a lot, is, you know, before you have success, you have this almost I've got nothing to lose mindset, which I feel unleashes insane amounts of creativity and this really high tolerance for risk that actually leads to the success. And then all of a sudden you feel like you have something to lose. And I'm wondering how you maintain that sort of naivete of a beginner who hasn't had the success that actually unleashes that kind of creativity. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It does. And you know, it's funny for me. I mean, I hate to sound like a broken record or like I'm avoiding the questions, but it really does just kind of all circle back to just being passionate about whatever it is that I'm doing. You know, it's, and I guess I really have moved around a bit. It's like, you know, I've been enjoying a lot of success in theater, and like now all of a sudden I'm doing film. And, you know, when I made that jump into theater, I had no idea what I was doing in theater. And I surrounded myself with mentors and with people who knew better and partners who knew what they were doing. And I learned, you know, and similarly, as I'm moving Fifth Beatle forward, I'm surrounding myself with producing partners and a creative team who really know what they're doing. And I'm learning from them. And, you know, so I guess in some ways, you know, as I've taken on mediums that I didn't know when I started them, you know, that felt very entrepreneurial. That did feel like the bursting into something where I was the beginner and the learner. But you know, I guess the bottom line for me is like, if I'm working on something that I believe in and that I'm passionate about, you know, then I don't worry about failure. I mean, it's like you don't have an option really. Like, I don't really ever find myself sitting back thinking like, ooh, now I have something to lose. Mm-hmm. You know, if I start doing The Fifth Beatle as a film, then and not focus more intensely on Broadway, I'm going to lose my Broadway background or something. It's like, nah, I got to make a film because because I'm passionate about the Brian Epstein story. And for a number of creative reasons, it feels to me more like a film than a Broadway show. So that's what I got to do. And it, you know, I just don't sit around thinking about things like, what do I have to lose? But then, you know, let me not be too disingenuous. Well, I'll reiterate also what I said earlier about, you know, financing. You know, like, you know, I need to also make sure that whatever it is that I'm pursuing, as risky or as whatever as it might be, that I've also created a structure, whether it means that past projects are bringing in reliable income or this future project has financial potential or whatever it may be, because I also now have two kids. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my son started kindergarten this year, and, you know, education in New York City is not cheap. And, you know, so I don't want to be too disingenuous about that. Like I do, it's not that I have nothing to lose, sure. But you know, as long as I, you know, keep working on things that I'm passionate about and make sure that I'm also working on things that I foresee, you know, have financial potential in them. And I've created a world for myself in which there is a baseline of security. You know, I don't find myself sort of, stressing out about, you know, having something to lose now that I've been successful. Mm-hmm.
So let me ask you this before we get into, you know, your creative process. I'm really just curious, you know, from the perspective that you've had. I mean, you've kind of, you and I both come from a world in which there actually was not a Facebook at a time, which I know there's probably people listening who can't even fathom such a world existing. And just given that you've been through the music industry, I'm really curious what your thoughts are on the implications that technology is going to have on the future of the arts and creativity.
That's an interesting question. You know, I mean, I'm not a tech guy myself, but I'm endlessly fascinated by technology, but it really does change a lot of the creative process. You know, for me, when I discovered the Brian Epstein story, you know, in 1991 in business school, you know, as I said, I was looking for a mentor and I couldn't find a living, breathing mentor. So I turned to history and I thought that the Beatles were the team that wrote and rewrote the rules of the pop music business. So I thought I should study the life of their manager, the guy who did all those things. And, you know, The Fifth Beatle, my book, is the only book in print about Brian Epstein. So there were no books that I could turn to. And, you know, in 1991, there was no YouTube, there was no Wikipedia, there was no Google. You know, there were none of these kind of online resources that we so take for granted today. And as a result, you know, it became like a little bit of a mystery. You know, I sort of thought, why is it that I can walk into a Barnes & Noble's and find a book about John Lennon's astrologist, and I can't find a book about the guy that managed the Beatles? You know, it's like it was so strange. And I was like, I got to uncover this mystery. You know, I got to track down, do old newspaper searches. And I started reading Beatles books, and I'd read these 200-page books about the Beatles and get 10 good pages about Brian. But slowly I painted a picture of the people in his world that knew him best. And then I literally just like, you know, pulled down the phone book. You know, I joke that was like the most cutting edge piece of technology back then was the phone book. Mm-hmm. You know, back then we used phone books, and I looked up the names and contact information of people who knew Brian and lived within a driving distance of New York City or Philadelphia, which I called home in Philadelphia where I was at school, and I just cold called them. And I said, you know, I'm a young person who's studying about Brian Epstein, and the little bit I know is very inspiring, and would you talk to me? And the way I describe it is that I was so excited to reach out to these people that I forgot to be intimidated. Mm-hmm. And not one of them turned me away. And it was fabulous. And that launched my depth of understanding on Brian Epstein. And as I look back on it, you know, if there had been a Wikipedia or a YouTube or a Google, you know, I probably would have looked up a couple of things, and there may have been a chance that I would have read a couple of articles and have satiated my interest and would have moved on to whatever the next thing was. You know, but because the information wasn't so readily available and had to come with effort and with work, you know, it felt more rewarding, more serious, or I was willing to put more of myself into it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just for me psychologically, when something is mysterious, it's immediately more interesting. Whereas if something's readily available and right there, it's just less interesting to me. I mean, that's just who I am. Like, you know, and so I feel like, you know, technology is changing that. You know, you don't need to wonder about anything anymore. You know, when you think, oh, I wonder why something this is that way, or I wonder who did this, or I wonder who created that. It's like, you don't really need to wonder. You just pull out your phone and Google it, and you can find out, you know, or you can at least find out, you know, enough to point yourself in the right direction. And I think there's marvelous aspects of that. You know, certainly when we were making the Fifth Beatle graphic novel, you know, it's a period piece, and we were very careful about wanting to capture the period, make sure that the phone booths were accurate and that JFK Airport, which was Idlewild, you know, was looked accurate, and the costumes were, you know, the wardrobe was accurate. And now that we have the internet, like, it's much easier to do that, you know, and you can go to Google Images or whatever reference points you need and study the history of JFK, like, and not have to, you know, spend 2 weeks trying to, you know, track down somebody who can talk to you, you know, who worked at JFK when it first got the name JFK, you know. And so there's certain elements of the creative process that I found having the internet is invaluable. Mm-hmm. But I think there's also elements of it that you know, there's are stymieing, I guess, and you just really need to draw out the best parts of it and focus on those. Yeah. And I guess I would only say, like, don't let technology make you lose the love of wondering.
I love that. So, you know, one of the things I really appreciate you said in that is that you were too excited to be intimidated. And it's funny, I think that people can sense enthusiasm. I think enthusiasm is just infectious. And when you're enthusiastic about something, people just want to help and be part of what you're doing.
I would agree with that 100-fold. Absolutely.
So, well, let's do this. We're close to about an hour. I want to spend a little bit of time dissecting the creative process for how something like a Broadway musical comes together, only because, you know, my creative efforts have involved putting on events. They've involved, you know, running the show and writing books. But, you know, I have no idea how a film gets made or how a Broadway production gets made. And I'd imagine there's some incredible creative lessons that come from that that can be applied to almost any other artistic endeavor.
Yeah, sure. I think you are right. So I'd be happy to talk about that. Is there any particular place you want to start?
I mean, really, you know, I mean, how does it start? Is it like I have an idea on a moleskin and, you know, I go from there? I mean, how does it go from something in your head to a sold out audience, which I realize is a big question.
Yeah, well, you know, I'll just use a current example, you know, that I am right now developing a show on Broadway. I'm working with Alanis Morissette to adapt her album Jagged Little Pill for the stage. We're very much in the early days. We are talking to writers right now. We haven't secured our writer yet. As you know, I am a writer, but I'm not planning on writing this. I'm acting as producer on this. And so, you know, the way that came about is, you know, in the wake of American Idiot, which was an incredibly fun and successful and critically acclaimed project for me. In the wake of that, and I was thinking a lot about that mold, that idea of taking, you know, a very successful, very seminal album and adapting it for Broadway. And because my background is the music industry, as I said, you know, that those are where my roots go. I got my start working for record labels. You know, I have a lot of contacts in that world. And so I found myself in this you know, somewhat unusual or unique, or you know, I don't know what the word is exactly, a niche that I may have built for myself as like sort of the pop rock Broadway guy. And I just was getting pitched an insane number of artists, you know, because I, you know, I knew the managers and I knew the rock managers and the booking agents, and, you know, they would all call me and they say, I rep so-and-so, and we're interested in maybe adapting their catalog or adapting this record for the Broadway stage. And so I was getting a ton of those. So this was something that I was very much thinking about. And you know, really what happened is, even though I was getting some wonderful opportunities, you know, to work with some very high profile artists and or catalogs, you know, I often just didn't see the story, you know, and for me, I'm a story guy and it all goes back to story. And, you know, so a lot of the, you know, nothing really made sense to me. I'd be like, oh, I love that catalog, or I love that band or that artist, but I just, you know, I don't know what the musical would be about. And if you can come back to me, or if he or she or they have a story idea they want to bounce around, like, then let's talk, you know. But, you know, one of my producing partners on Jagged Little Pill, Arvin David, to give him his credit, you know, it was initially his idea. You know, as we were talking about this, he's new to Broadway. This will be his first Broadway show. But he said to me as we were talking about it, he said, you know, what do you think about Jagged Little Pill? You know, I've always thought that that would be a really great musical. And I thought, huh. And I went back and I listened to the record, and he was absolutely right. You know, the songs to me really held up, and they felt very theatrical. They felt that, like, they play very big and epic and bold, like she's singing to the back of the room, to use a Broadway phrase, to use a theatrical phrase, playing to the back of the room. But the content of the songs is so small and interior. You know, it's very personal. It's like she might be singing this big epic song, sonically speaking, but the content is, this is what happened to me last weekend or last summer. You know, and that to me is the hallmark of a great musical song. You know, where that's very personal, and you really feel like you're getting to know the character through the material, but it also plays very big and epic into the back of the room. So, you know, I didn't know Alanis's management directly at the time, but the music industry is a very small world, and I had been operating successfully in it, and so I got a referral to her manager, and explained my ideas and what we kind of were thinking for Jagged Little Pill, and the manager said, Alanis is going to love you, and she's going to love these ideas, and let me get you guys together so that you can talk to her. And we did, and she did very much like kind of the ideas that I had for it and how we wanted to roll it out. And then we were sort of off to the races. And then you know, the next step is obviously the legal side of things, like legally, you know, securing the rights to the music publishing with the publishers. And you know, Glenn Ballard co-wrote those songs, so we have to involve, you know, his music publishers. And, you know, so there's a number of legal stuff, and then, you know, all of a sudden getting the lawyers and the business folks on board. So that's what happens then. Mm-hmm. And then after that, you know, we are now starting to talk to writers. You know, we put a small list of writers together that we think are appropriate for, you know, for kind of the take and the tone and the vibe that we want for the piece, and then reach out to them. And simultaneously, you know, a high profile project like this, we announced it and it got pickup all over the world, you know, reported that it was happening. And so a handful of great writers reached out to us saying, I heard you're doing this and are you looking for a writer? And, you know, so we would just kind of hone in on that list, and we're just meeting with the best of them. And you know, Arvind and I will take those first meetings, and then we'll set the writer down with Alanis, you know, so we'll be the first filter, and, you know, and then she'll meet who we think are the best of the lot. And that's kind of where we're at right now. But then after that, you know, we will pick our writer. And you know, we'll start working on a first draft of the book. Book is the phrase that is basically a musical script. It's called a book. And then we'll probably put together some sort of workshop that will be a sample of the show. It might be a couple of songs with very loose choreography. It might be a whole act. You know, it depends on kind of how the show kind of works itself out. And then I suspect for something like this, we will plan on doing some sort of out-of-town tryout, and we'll just build the show, and at some point start to attach director and cast, and then start reaching out to investors and start raising money, you know, putting a budget together, knowing how much it's going to cost, and raising the money, and then talking to theater owners and booking a theater, and then scheduling it and hiring a marketing company and working with that marketing company to market your show, and then you're just kind of off to the races at that point.
Wow. You know, the thing that I hear as I listen to you describe that is, you know, what our friend Peter Sims calls little bets. It's a series of things that you do that give you feedback, and then you just keep iterating on that until you get to sort of the end result of what you're looking to do. Because I think that most people think of something as big as a Broadway production, they're like, okay, that sounds crazy. How could I possibly pull off something that massive?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting way of putting it, little bets, you know, because it really does start in, I mean, you know, this is why Broadway shows and film for that matter as well, you know, they take years and years and years to put together. Mm-hmm. And that's because they really do start in with baby steps. Yeah. You know,
let me ask you this. Are there any moments where, you know, like that moment when you say, okay, that's it, tickets are on sale. Do you ever have a moment of shit, like, this is terrifying? And the only reason I ask that is because, you know, one of my personal experiences of putting on an event was, oh my God, we just signed with the venue and now our asses are on the line. We have to sell these tickets.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, there are definitely those moments, but again, it's, you know, to me, that's a matter of perspective. Like, yeah, you know, in those moments for me, I definitely have some, you know, I guess what you would call stereotypical negative emotions, like sure, anxiety and concern and that sort of thing. But I also try to focus on the positive emotions, which is the excitement that we're there, you know? Mm-hmm. So I never wind up feeling, you know, the word you used was terrified.
Right.
You know, at worst, I'll feel, you know, anxiously excited. Hmm. And that to me would be my advice in those moments, is really just try to focus on the excitement of reaching that stage, as opposed to, you know, the fear of, is it going to work?
Right. I love that idea of anxious excitement. That's a really good way of reframing it.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Well, Vivek, this has been just mind-blowingly interesting. I think you're actually the first Broadway producer I've ever had here at the Unmistakable Creative.
Well, I hope I'm the first of many.
Yeah, well, so do I, because this has been really, really mind-blowingly cool. So, you know, I want to wrap with my final question, which is how I close all my interviews at the Unmistakable Creative. What is it? I mean, after seeing all the artists that you've seen, producing all the work that you have, that you think makes somebody or something unmistakable?
You know, I guess I'm going to go back to this word that you've probably heard me use over and over and over again on this call, and that's passion. You know, I really do believe, you know, if somebody or some project or team or whatever is really passionate about whatever it is that they do, that will shine through, you know, because passion equals enthusiasm and excitement, and passion is tied to dreams. And to me, that's what it's all about. It all boils down to passion.
Awesome. Well, Vivek, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share some of your insights with our listeners here at the Unmistakable Creative.
It has been my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. It really has been an honor.
Awesome. And for those of you guys listening, I'll link up things that Vivek has mentioned in the show notes. Definitely check out the TED Talk that he did. It's really, really cool. And we will wrap the show with that.
Yeah, if I can make a quick plug, if you're interested in learning more about me and my projects, you know, you can go to fifthbeetle.com, and we have a mailing list there. And Fifth Beetle also is on Facebook at the Fifth Beetle, and we're on Twitter at Fifth Beetle. And we do expect to be making some exciting film announcements in the next handful of months. The film is on track to shoot next year, so please do follow us and support those efforts. And if you're interested in just keeping tabs on me and my projects in general, my company website is tiwaryent.com, T-I-W-A-R-Y-E-N-T.com. And I am personally on Twitter at Vivek J. Tiwari.
Awesome. And for those of you guys listening, we'll wrap with that. If you like what you heard, the greatest compliment you could give us is to share the show with a friend and let people know what you think by leaving a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening to The Unmistakable Creative.